Hi, this is so nice to be with you guys for this time of questions and conversation. So, good afternoon, good evening, good morning, and welcome. I was reading through the notes on the listserv a few minutes ago, and I came across Phyllis's very beautiful sharing. And she was talking about actually, I think she, actually Phyllis, she sent it to me, so it's not on the listserv. It was in a private email. But one of the things that she talked about was Aurobindo's little book, The Mother, which is one of the first books I ever read about goddess that really unfurled this understanding about the divine feminine, both as Chiti Shakti, as the subtle creative consciousness, and also as the he calls them the different powers and personalities of the goddess. The fact that we may experience Chiti Shakti in so many different guises, and yet she is always functioning as the force that both gives us life and makes it possible for us to know ourselves as what we are. So I want to just read his take on the Shakta non-duality, the tantric non-duality, and his language and his first of all, his language is very much the formal language of late 19th century, early 20th century English. The way that people spoke and wrote in the early years of the last century. So his language is, it can be thick. I wouldn't say that Aurobindo as a teacher is user-friendly exactly, but he is extremely profound. And these are just some of the things that's jumped out at me as I found this book, as I opened this book. All the scenes of the earth play have been like a drama arranged and planned and staged by her, with the cosmic gods for her assistants and herself as a veiled actor. The mother not only governs all from above, but she descends into this physical triple universe, by which he means she descends into the three human states of waking, dream, and deep sleep, into the physical body, the subtle body, and the causal body, the very deep, mysterious body that is the home of the veiling of Maya, and is also the place where we experience deep rest. Impersonally, all things here, even the movements of ignorance, are herself in veiled power and her creations in diminished substance, her body of nature and her Shakti, and they exist because moved by the supreme fiat of Shakti to work out something that was there in the possibilities of the infinite. She has consented to the great sacrifice and has put on like a mask the soul and forms of ignorance. But personally too, she has stepped here into the darkness so that she may lead it to the light, into the false understanding so that she may reveal in it the truth, into the death that she may turn it to immortal life, into this world pain and its obstinate sorrow and suffering, that she may end it in the transforming ecstasy of her sublime Ananda. In her deep and great love for her children, she has consented to put on herself the cloak of this obscurity. She has been willing to bear the attacks and torturing influences of the powers of the darkness and the untruth, born to pass through the portals of the birth that is a death. I think by that he means entering into a body, taking upon herself the pangs and sorrows and sufferings of the creation, since it seemed that thus alone could it be lifted to the light and joy and truth and eternal life. This is the great sacrifice, called sometimes the sacrifice of the Purusha, but much more deeply, the holocaust of Prakriti, the sacrifice of the Divine Mother. So he's speaking here from many different strands of the Indian tradition, specifically from the Vedas, which, as many of you know, have a beautiful image of this physical world as the body of Purusha, the divine person. And what Aurobindo is saying, as Kshemaraja is saying, as we are recognizing in our study, is that it is really Goddess, it is Chitti Shakti, who offers herself in the form of that subtle substance called Prakriti, out of which all of this takes form. And as us, she lives and suffers and experiences all the confusion and pain and eventually the seeking that all of us here are engaged in now and have been engaged in perhaps for many lifetimes. As we, little by little and sometimes all in a rush, surrender, because that is what it is, to making the subtle effort to recognize who it is that's doing everything, who it is that's living our lives, and who it is that is actually, in my experience, longing to show us the truth about ourselves. So we're going to take some questions, but first let's sit for a moment. Take a few deep breaths. And let's offer our practice tonight, asking that it be of benefit to all beings. Asking that all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. That all beings be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. That all beings know the sacred joy that lies beyond suffering. That we experience the equanimity that lies beyond hatred, grasping, and dullness, and that we know the equality of all that lives. And as the breath flows in and flows out, allow yourself to feel how the Chitti Shakti, the incomparably subtle energy of the Supreme Reality, descending second by second through layers of subtler and denser energies, manifests as the Prana Shakti that gives us life, that we draw into our bodies with the inhalation, and that also becomes the connection point that we can follow back into the recognition of what we are. So let's just sit with the breath, feeling the breath as particles of light energy flowing in and down through the center of the body, flowing up and out through the crown, connecting us to the earth with the inhalation, to the sun with the exhalation. So we can open our eyes and let's see. Deb, are there questions that came in on the webcast?
Yeah, I have a question from, excuse me if I'm saying this wrong, but Gaius asks, first she says, thank you for your generous teaching. Does expecting the experience of awareness prevent it from taking place? And paradoxically, does paradoxically effort could abstract grace? I'm not sure on that. Where is the line between perseverance and trying too hard?
Oh, yes. What a great question. It's interesting that you ask that question because as I was leafing through Aurobindo's book, The Mother, I came across a passage that pretty much describes that, you know, how we have to find that balance. He starts this book by saying something that always kind of sends chills up and down my spine, and many of you have heard me quote it before. There are two powers that alone can affect in their conjunction the great and difficult thing, which is the aim of our endeavor. The first one is a fixed and unfailing aspiration that calls from below, and a supreme grace that answers from above. And what he goes on to say, and what I think is at the base of your question, and certainly is my experience over the years, is that our aspiration, what he often calls the calling from below, is actually the effort that we make to connect to awareness, to connect to a goddess form, to connect to mantra, to connect to our own aspiration. And the effort is necessary. We, you know, even though, of course, there are definitely examples in, and I am one of them, and I think many of you on this call are among them, you know, we do experience openings that have nothing to do with our effort, but it is actually the incremental attention to the highest possible experience of ourselves at any given moment that opens us to grace over a period of time. And yes, there is a subtle line between not trying and trying too hard. And it's a subject that spiritual masters have talked about endlessly. If you remember Buddha's famous statement about the kind of effort we should make, not too tight and not too loose, he uses the example of the strings of a tambura, of that wonderful Indian drone instrument, that if it's too loose, there's no tune. If it's too tight, there's no tune. So, yes, we all have to find our sweet spot between trying too hard and a kind of flaccidity, of that. And if we think of it in terms of the gunas, there's a kind of effort that we could call rajasic effort. That is, it's filled with ambition and striving and the sense of I'm working very hard to make this happen. And then there's the state of tamasic effort, in which we basically give in to our discouragement or our, not feeling like sitting today. And then in the kind of harmonizing position, there's the sattvic kind of effort where the effort consists of staying as close as possible to the highest level of reality that we can touch and constantly applying our understanding of that subtlety to the experiences of our day-to-day life, as in the process that we were working with at the end of the class and have been working with this week, for practicing with our samskaras, our negative impressions, by holding them in awareness because awareness is for many of us the subtlest way that we, the subtlest aspect of the mind that we can find in ordinary situations. But you know, one of the beautiful things about the tantric sages is that they did give us many, many methods for staying in touch with that aspect of our personal reality that is going to connect us to the grace bestowing function, and our effort doesn't need to be intense. It simply needs to be steady, and in my experience, we learn how to make effort in the right way. That is, normally we come into spiritual practice with craving for results and carrying all of our work habits from our past life. And, you know, so we have to learn how to make subtle effort. And that's something that each of us gets to learn how to do in our own way. And we do it by actually practicing, by doing it. So you begin to notice, oh, okay, there's anxiety in my mind now. And, you know, the feeling of anxiety is one of the best indicators that your effort is too ambitious, let's say, or too attached, or that you're trying too hard. And you also begin to notice the other extreme, which is that voice that says, okay, it's not really such a great day for meditation, and, you know, maybe I'll just let myself fall asleep. You know, it's, and for most of us, you know, there's, as we practice, as we get to know our own practice moods, we start to notice when there's anxiety and striving, and when there's a kind of, you know, disinterest, or I hate to use the word laziness because it has so many negative connotations, but, you know, our sleepiness, our slothfulness, as you know, that, as you know, is one way of talking about it, our tamas. So so we learn to make the right kind of effort, but in terms of the other aspect of your question, nothing can obscure the flow of grace. There's the streams of grace that are flowing to each one of you, to each one of us in this process, are utterly unobstructible. And one of my teachers used to say, grace is much stronger than your negativity, which is something that I've remembered, because, you know, it's actually very reassuring. No matter how bad you're feeling in any particular moment, and that includes how bad you're feeling about yourself, the rays of grace are always going to be beaming towards you. And, you know, even when you forget that grace is there, even when you're completely lost in your stuff, one 30-second remembrance of the presence of the grace energy in the universe can be enough to just change your whole perspective. So thank you for that question. So, Deb, do we have other?
Yeah. I was going to say, if anybody wants to ask a question, you just hit star 2, and I'll see your hand raised. We have another question from the web. Laurel asks, if you would speak to the dance of the divine beloved within us, deepening this, Shakti Shiva embrace within, and us as Shakti embrace as Shiva.
Well, let me give you a way to look for that dance that's always going on within us. One of the practices that can really start to give you a subtle sense of how the dance is going on within us is to follow the breath in the central channel and just let yourself get more and more present to the breath and to that inner flow, and then every now and then turn to awareness. One of the reasons that I like to do these two practices together is because one of the most immediate ways that we experience Shakti is as the breath. And one of the most immediate ways that we experience Shiva is as this sense of a witnessing presence that that we can turn to, that we can almost trick ourselves into turning to by asking a question like, am I aware? You know, if you ask the question, am I aware? Something about that question kind of stops thoughts for a second or two, and you can actually start to become aware of that suchness that is aware, and that has nothing to do with thinking. So as you really let yourself dance with the breath and let the breath take you deeper and deeper into connection with your inner body and eventually with the deep subtleties of your inner body, and just keep remembering to turn every now and then to, am I aware? And feel into that which is waiting, watching, present through all the permutations of the dance, that you do begin to experience the fact that Shiva and Shakti are really endlessly dancing within you as the play between breath and awareness. This kind of attention is possible really in any moment, and is, as you know, at the heart of spiritual practice. So I can speak a little bit, but you know, let's take some more questions. I can speak a little bit about Shiva practice and Shakti practice, which is a topic that I think is actually very important for us to become aware of, because all of us pursue our path of sadhana by finding a balance between the practices that put us in touch with the felt sense of ananda, which is very much a gift of practicing with mantra, practicing with breath, practicing with the visualizations, the practices we do with the chakras, that as we, you know, as these are all Shakti practices, because they all teach us how to become more and more attuned to the subtle dynamism inside our consciousness. And what we could call the Shiva practices are that steady intention to become aware of your own awareness, of your own witness consciousness, that utterly still and never not present aspect of your being that can feel very hidden, but which we coax into revealing itself through the power of attention, which we've been speaking about a bit this week. The practices that we've been working with as we move through the teachings of Sutras 10 and 11 really are meant to tune us into the extraordinary creative power of our attention. So as attention moves more and more deeply into the aspects of your embodiment that help turn the density of our identification with the body and mind into the subtlety of identifying with the knowing parts of ourselves, with identifying with the pure pulsation of Shakti in the breath and in the body and in the chakras, that this kind of integration of the Shiva-Shakti aspect of our being begins to happen through our recognition that whatever we pay attention to is going to grow and reveal more and more of that aspect of ourselves. So one more thing, because it's been coming up in my mind and I wanted to say it. There's a statement of Abhinava Gupta's which I think is really, really crucial. It's a commentary on a text called the Malini Vijaya Tantra. And he says, this above all is important, that your mind be attached to the highest reality. It matters little how this is attained. This above all is important, that your mind be attached to the highest reality. It matters little how this is attained. And what we're seeing in this class is that the absolute rigor of Kshema Raja's account of involution, and now starting next week, we're moving into the return journey. The text begins to speak about what it actually is for Shakti to unfold the truth within you. That you know, the way you attach your mind to the highest reality can be through a mantra, through deep meditation, through awareness of awareness, through studying a text like this one, through sacred dance, through meditation on the chakras. It's all, you know, there's so many ways in which we can do this, so many upayas, as the tradition says, and some of them lead us towards stillness, transcendence, and some of us are aim at showing us the divinity in the immanent. And we can say that the ones which lead us towards the transcendent are the Shiva aspect of the dance, and the ones that show us the divinity in the immanent are the Shakti aspects of the dance. But of course, they're inseparable. So we're always in the dance, whether we're directly aware of it or not.
So
I hope that was
question.
Helpful.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. Let's hear the
okay.
question.
So the next question is from Claire. She said she was listening to last week's class for the third time today and found a profound difference between the first two and today, especially during the beginning guided meditation you led. The first two, I'm assuming times, she listened to it. I was lying down and soon disappeared into the light. Gone as in gone, gone, gone. But today she sat in half lotus, which seemed to allow this physical body to remain in my in her awareness while still felt sensing the body dissolving in the light. Does this make sense to you? And is it implying that this is the point of posture?
Yeah. Yes. Yes. I think, you know, sometimes we have to lie down, and it's not that you can't meditate lying down, but the chances of you're going into a state of unawareness when you're lying down are much greater. So yes, the point of posture, half lotus is great. It doesn't have to be half lotus, as long as the back is upright. And this actually allows the energies in the body to move between the Muladhara chakra and the Sahasrara in a much more easeful and direct way, in at least in my experience. So we tend to be able to stay aware while going into kind of increasingly deep meditative states much more easily if we're sitting up. So thank you, Claire.
Okay, we have another question from the web. Marion Ray says, when encountering an interaction with a person one thinks is really far out of balance, is it best to turn attention to the grace energy in the universe or interact with the out-of-balance person in the present? She asked this because of a near neighbor who thinks I'm poisoning him with my garden and is yelling at me from his windows and patio, etc. She's bouncing between bliss and startled response, and she has not found a way to manage this. They have not spoken for 8 months, have withdrawn my energy, have sent positive energy, nothing has worked, and I am not sure how to see this situation where I seem to be the intense focus of his attention. Am I to attach to the highest reality while he is yelling at me? And she hopes this question is not out of order.
No, very, Yes, that's a very challenging situation. I think that there are situations in our lives when we are dealing with people who are out of bounds, and it sounds like he's a bit out of his mind. So we have to work with these situations on several levels. One of which, obviously, is to protect your space. And I would say that, you probably, I don't know the history, but some degree of firmness and making it clear that you're not, that, you're setting boundaries such that it's not okay for him to yell at you, that is very important, a kind of clarity of self-protection and sending positive energy, or even more, sending energy into your own confidence in your capacity to hold the space for yourself in the situation is really extremely important. And if you find that you can't have a rational conversation with him, then your best tactic probably is to ignore him. So I can't give you advice about what to do in this situation other than to say that at some point it usually becomes important for us to take some clear action in the relationship, to say something, to do something to create a boundary. And secondly, that often when somebody is, disturbed in this way, that ignoring them and not engaging with them past the point of you're making it very clear what your position is, very often the ignoring them gives them space to kind of cool out, to chill out. So you have to be the judge of how much action is necessary in the physical world, but having a positive viewpoint and turning towards really holding space for the situation, even to the point of imagining space around the whole situation, or doing a kind of shamanic practice where you imagine yourself in a subtle realm, actually having a conversation in which you say to him the things that you can't say in the physical realm, can actually be very helpful. There's a shamanic practice with somebody that you're having a very hard time with, where you imagine yourself in conversation somewhere, on some plane that you can recognize as being subtler than this one, even just imagining yourselves someplace in the sky having a conversation. And then you give the person flowers. You say what you need to say and give them flowers, which symbolically in the language of the subtle body, an offering of flowers is felt as a peace offering. And even though the person may have no, rational understanding of what it is that you're doing, this kind of subtle peace offering can often make a lot of difference in the way your interactions go. I've done this myself many times with difficult people, and it always makes a difference.
I'm just going to remind everybody, if you want to ask a question, hit star 2. We haven't had anybody ask a question from the list yet, so, or from the callers.
Okay, guys. Now's your chance.
Yes, because I'm out of questions from the web.
Okay, so,
oh,
so
fine. Okay, I've got one. We have someone from New York. Go ahead and speak if you raised your question. Raised your hand.
Great, thank you. Hi, Sally. This is me too.
Hi, me too.
Hi, I have been loving this class, and My question is very ill-formed, so I will try to say it concisely, but it goes back to the first class and the first sutra and the notion of Jiti manifesting on the screen. And it's gotten me thinking a lot about our DNA, which feels like it similarly does the same thing, like how we read ourselves. Right, the DNA itself needs to manufacture something that can be apart from it and read itself and therefore create.
Wow.
And I remember in that first class, I've listened to it a couple of times, you've also talked about self-organizing systems and dynamics. And
right.
Like I said, my question's not well-formed, but I'm hoping you can talk a little bit more to that and how we see that reflected in so many biological and physical and other systems in ourselves and in society. Because for me, that helps take something that's otherwise really abstract and bring it into the world and make it something I can relate to.
Right. Well, so I'm going to just say this generally because physics and neuroscience are not topics that I consider myself well enough informed into to speak about these correspondences accurately. But the thing that we notice as we inform ourselves about contemporary physics and contemporary neuroscience is how these patterns seem to operate throughout every part of the universe. I mean, I'm just thinking of the idea of fractals, how these particular patterns, which are, replicated in galaxies, they're replicated in plants, they're replicated in our cellular, the structure of our nervous system. They're in different aspects of, transformation and growth happen in the cells. So the more we study the physical world and especially the human body, which I think is what the sages, my experience is that, and my feeling is that the sages actually based a lot of their understanding about the higher realities on what they experienced in their human body mind. Because the recognition that whatever we are experiencing here is a mirror of what's being experienced there, meaning in other parts of the galaxy, in other bodies, and to the study of how this works, which is what a lot of scientists, or not a lot of scientists, but some scientists, are very concerned with these days, concepts like quantum entanglement, this understanding that bodies and widely separated, I mean separated by sometimes millions of miles, can affect each other because there is connection between all levels of this cosmos. So I agree with you that the more we can connect these issues to the experiences that science is beginning to reveal to us about subatomic particles and about the inner workings of our nervous system, the more we understand the way in which the same laws seem to apply all the way up and all the way down, the more we realize that to say that this universe is a self-organizing system is a much, much bigger concept than we even can conceive of in our studies of the physical world. That, in fact, the self-organizing systems that we see in families, that we see in, ecosystems, that we see in the galaxy, that we see in virtually every system that we've been able to study, that this is a mirror image of the big self-organization, which is the entire process of manifesting all this from within herself that Chitti does. So I really do recommend Deepak and Manas's book, You Are the Universe. I also recommend the work of Stuart Hoffman, who's a biologist who writes a lot about this from the neurophysiological viewpoint. And Ritu, you know, you have this bent yourself. I think it's an important thing for each of us to do is to start really looking at some of these discoveries that are occurring in the scientific world, and without doing a kind of, you know, without trying to make false equivalences, to start to appreciate the subtlety of the way of the mirroring that goes on every level of this cosmos.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we have someone from Oregon.
Hi. Hi, Sally. It's Wendy.
Hi, Wendy.
How are you? Thank you.
I'm great.
Understanding this fivefold act is something that comes easier to me when I think about it in the external world,
mm-hmm.
for some reason. Like, I can completely conceive of how all those activities of creation, maintenance, dissolution, and concealment,
right.
you know, and revelation, you know, happens just in the course of every day, just around you. But,
right.
you know, interestingly, on the definitions that you gave on the third page of the homework, you know, of looking at them internally,
mm-hmm.
feels different than how I think about them externally. Just when I read them, you know, the idea of maintenance to me.
Wait a second, Wendy. Are you talking? I'm just going to find the document. Are you talking about the meditation?
Yeah,
homework
when it
the,
says, yeah, no, it's the meditation homework where you say
okay.
he performs those five acts through manifestation, attachment, subject awareness, settling of the seed, and dissolving it. But in this explanation about Sutra 11, and then I'm probably saying these words wrong.
Abhasana, yeah.
Rakshi, Vimarsana, and Viva, you know. So it's like when I think of Rakti, that's like attaching your mind to something. That seems different to me than trying to keep something going, like, you know, a project or whatever. Like, it seems So I wonder if you could speak about that. And then I don't know if these questions match up or not, but, you know, like, I can't stop thinking about the gunas when I think about the malas, or anamalas.
It seems like they're the same thing, right? Well, as you probably noticed, triads are a big thing in this tradition. So, yes, the gunas and the malas can be connected to each other. I don't think they're really exactly equivalent.
Like when you're totally rajas all the time and striving and thriving, like my whole MO, you know, then, you know, but like, why am I doing that? Because I feel worthless, because I'm constantly feeling like I'm different, because I believe I'm the doer. I mean, like, all those gunas activities, like, speak to the anamalas, I think. I don't know.
Yes. Well, yes, absolutely. Let me just go over the malas very, very briefly. We start off with separation, with anava mala, which immediately reduces us, makes us feel separate from reality, from the truth, from the great mother, you know, from a universe that immediately begins to feel hostile. You know,
well, and also from each other, right? Like, isn't that the same way we don't feel love?
The separation. So wait a sec. So the separation from each other is a slightly later phase, because in order to feel separate from each other, we have to recognize, we have to start to see other. You know, you see what I mean? So there is initially this feeling of separation from the wholeness, and then we get the experience of being a particular someone in a world with others, and at that point we begin to all those things that you're talking about, the gunas, come into the story. We begin to strive, we begin to act with the feeling that we are the actor, and most of what you're talking about is actually the experience of karma mala, you know, which is the first thing that most of us become aware of on the spiritual path, as we start to realize how completely nailed we are by the feeling of being the doers of our actions and the thinkers of our thoughts. You know, that experience
isn't that like attached to that whole idea of like just kind of like doing the work for the fruits of the labor instead of just doing the work?
Yes, absolutely. But as you know, it's much subtler than that. You know, the roots of it are very, very deeply embedded in us. They're embedded in the sense of being a particular person, and the feeling that you are the one who has to make your life happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is what causes that, you know, kind of neurotic striving that we all do. But in terms of your initial question,
mm-hmm.
about Sutra 11,
mm-hmm.
the experience of externally manifesting, sustaining, and dissolving, when you create a project, there's a very obvious, you know, experience of making something happen and sustaining the effort, and then it's over and the effort dissolves. What he's talking about in Sutra 11 is a very, very subtle process in which you actually start to look at the way perception and thinking occurs granularly, moment by moment by moment. So it is actually a process that is meant to get us to do an extremely specific form of inner focus, not so much looking at how something feels per se, but at what the process actually is of looking at a flower, having a conversation. So let's say right now you're listening to me, and in listening to me, you are actually making me real for yourself, and you're also making real for yourself your reactions and your sense of where you are in space and time at this moment. And you could either have a glancing, oh, okay, she's talking, and go off into a daydream, or, you know, check your Twitter feed. There are many, many things you could do once you have had that initial experience of something manifesting on the screen of your awareness. Arukti literally, actually, in our perception process, it just means to sustain your focus.
Okay.
No,
that's really helpful.
Yeah,
so
it's about attention. This whole sutra is about attention.
Okay.
That's why it's called esoteric, because, you know, it's not about action. It's about watching your own process of attention.
Mm-hmm. And so the idea is that the reason the third phase talks about, what does it say exactly?
Beach of Astapana refers to the process by, I'm reading from the homework, by which, I'm sorry, Vimarsha means to become aware of yourself as a subjective enjoyer of the object.
And so the idea is that at that moment, as soon as you're aware that your attention is on the thing, that's the moment it dissolves?
Yes, but let me just say one more thing about it. Once you really start noticing how it works to focus on an object, what you start to notice is that attention actually does not sustain itself for too long. In other words, there is a natural kind of rhythm of attention where, you know, I'm looking at the candle flame, and in a very natural way, at a certain point, I become aware, oh, I'm looking at the candle flame. You know, it's one of the reasons why meditation is so frustrating so much of the time, because, you know, something will arise. Those of you who are visual might, you know, a light might arise. You might, you know, a feeling of bliss might arise, and you're experiencing it. And that, so that, you know, the arising of the light or of the bliss would be abhasana. That's appearing, right, in your consciousness. And and you focus on it. You're caught in it. You go, oh, you know, you experience it. And then there's this natural movement backwards. Oh, my God, I'm experiencing a light.
Right. And then at the moment you experience it, that's what they consider dissolution from the...
Yes, exactly. And that, you know, if you think about what that means, it actually is the secret of flow. So in other words, at the moment when you turn back and become aware of yourself as the subject, you actually leave behind the experience.
Right.
You know, so if you're sensing into how you, Wendy, feel in this interaction, in that moment that you're tuning into that sense of yourself as the subject, you're kind of tuning me out.
Right.
You know, you have to, because that's how attention
works.
Well,
that's like that whole idea when you were talking about the thoughts you have and all that stuff about the secret and all that business you were talking about. Like, as soon as you are thinking of your response, you're not in that moment.
Exactly. And what this sutra is saying is that this is normal. I mean, it's not that you should be able to be in the present moment, unremittingly, as it were. It's not that you should be able to focus unremittingly in order to be a successful tantric practitioner.
Mm-hmm.
You actually can begin to recognize that in every act of perception, and this is best gotten in meditation, because, you know, normally we're just moving too fast to get it. But I think you'll find, as you start to look at the process in yourself as you're sitting, you'll start to see how, everything that you focus on in meditation will start to become sharp as you focus on it. And then when you become aware of yourself as the focuser or as the meditator, what you're focusing on will become fuzzier. And your experience will be more deeply of yourself as the experiencer. And what he's saying here is that if you can go through your life turning to the self with every moment that this natural interning of attention happens, and let the object go.
Next part, putting it into memory?
Well, then what happens is, fourth process, yes. But, of course, we don't let it go. You know, it actually goes into our memory. That's the sort of paradox of this sutra. So the Bijavastapana, you know, it actually refers to the process by which impressions go into the memory. His point is that the way we clog up our consciousness is by simply by this process of stuffing impressions into the memory. And what Kshema Raja says in his commentary, and I should get the book out in front of me, what he says in his commentary is that what makes impressions get stuck in our consciousness is, generally speaking, our anxiety, our insecurity, you know, our negative experience of them.
Concealing? Is that why it's concealing?
Yes. That's why it's concealing. Right, exactly, because the experience doesn't move through cleanly. You know, for instance, if you're listening to me and you turn to yourself and you tune me out, there's a voice in you that's going, "Oh, I tuned her out," or "I was having a boring experience listening to her, so I don't understand," whatever the negative reaction is to that moment, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what causes the incident to get stuck in your consciousness and become a seed that will get triggered later on. And so what this verse is describing is the process by which ordinary experience is entered into through attention, and how it becomes lodged or stuck in consciousness such that we're not able to experience our own consciousness, you know, thought free, because we have so many bijas stored there. And
so the instruction then in that is to, like, when you're paying attention at that moment, instead you do this dissolving the thought.
Yeah. When you become aware that, you know, that there's because I've been working kind of intensely with this sutra all week, I'm having a lot of different experiences of it, and one of them, you know, is the recognition that there's so many impressions getting lodged in consciousness that you can't dissolve them all, right? But what you can do is start to notice when you're having an uncomfortable feeling, which is almost always a sign that something that's occurred in your external life or in your perception is triggering some of your stored negative samskaras.
Mm-hmm.
And what this sutra is doing is actually giving us the encouragement to dissolve those uncomfortable impressions in the moment that you notice them. In other words, you can use this sutra as an invitation to self-inquiry through this process. And I feel that this is one of the most productive pointing out instructions that the text gives us, you know, about this major problem that we all have, which is that our consciousnesses are so stuffed with, you know, our karmic impressions that it's sometimes hard to find the clarity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so he's just saying when you notice yourself out of sorts, or when you notice a discomfort, rather than storing yet another memory of discomfort,
mm-hmm.
do a practice for dissolving it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, it totally makes sense, and it's very clarifying. I really appreciate it, and now I know why I was just stuck on the external. But, you know, even on the external, in some ways, the same thing happens. If you just do the very first thing you taught, when you just, like, say, you go back to the awareness behind you, you know? So
right.
I've been just doing that all the time. And I had this total heartbreaking betrayal happen right when the class started. And I haven't I've just been trying to sit with it. And what happened just today was, like, when I looked at the event again, now through all of this, what we've been talking about, just from that same place, it was really amazing how the original event, which was so sharp and just broke my heart, it was like from that perspective behind me, the awareness of the awareness.
Yeah.
Like it was nothing. It was like, it was just all of it was what was in me. The event was not the thing, you know? So, so that was really interesting too.
That's great. And that, I mean, but that's exactly right. That when you find, you know, there are different ways to shift perspective to this sense of the big awareness, and different ones are powerful for us at different moments. But you're absolutely right that the thing that makes us cling to negative experiences or to, you know, experiences of something that kindle our desire is that tight identification with this limited consciousness, and that the moment that you make space by widening your awareness, it's gonna shift your perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, it's really so great, Sally, and you're just such an incredible jewel in the world. So thank you.
Well, thank you for bringing this question. I mean, especially the confusion about Rakti, the way it sort of plays into our idea about what attachment means.
Yeah. No,
yeah,
it's very helpful to go do this.
Thank
again.
You for asking
so,
this.
Thanks. Yeah, I wish you could teach this for 20 weeks.
I know, I do too. I've been thinking that too.
Anyway, thanks so much, Sally. Yes.
Oh, thank you, sweetheart. So, dear ones, it's a little after 6 my time, and I want to give you the opportunity to get back to your day. There don't seem to be any other hands raised. So,
well, I have one more question.
Oh,
Sally.
Okay, yeah.
There's one more question here that I think is worth going back for a few minutes, if you don't mind. She has a question about practice. She feels like she's reached the limit of her ability to understand the teaching. It's as if she really can't get it anymore, even if she sits with the homework and reads it and tries to understand. Maybe it's because she's exhausted physically, mentally, emotionally. In any case, is there any way she can practice without simply giving up and stop trying to understand?
Well, I have 2 suggestions. One is that I honestly promise you that if you keep listening to the classes, understanding will come, because it's what you're talking about is the kind of unfamiliarity that this teaching kindles. I mean, this is an unfamiliar teaching to many of us, and when it's unfamiliar, it can feel difficult to grasp intellectually. The practice itself, I mean, actually just doing the meditations and walking around with the open-eyed awareness practices, you know, the walking around practices, for example, my heart is the divine heart, or everything that is occurring that seems to me to be outside me is actually being manifested from within me. Just walking around with those sentences in your mind, not trying to figure them out, not trying to understand them, but just holding them in your consciousness and allowing them to reveal something to you, because associations will start to come up, recognitions will start to come up, parts of your being will relax. So don't worry about trying to understand it. Do your daily meditation practice and spend some time with one or another of the walking around awarenesses. And, you know, they're the second item in the meditation and contemplation homework. Those practices I have found over the years for myself and almost everyone who studies this text. What can we call them? One of my friends calls them guru statements. You know, they're in Sanskrit, they're called mahavakyas, great teachings, great statements. They're statements of truth that you can just inject into your mental consciousness the way you would drop one of those Japanese flowers into water, you know, those little scrunched up pieces of paper, you put them in water and they blossom. That's what these statements can do. And I also would suggest that you do listen to the classes a few times and do the practices with us in the class. And you don't worry about whether you understand it. That simply exposing yourself to the teachings is going to create in you the intuitive wisdom, which is what understands these teachings. So I hope that helps. Meditate, do the open-eyed awareness practices, listen another time to the classes. Don't worry if you understand it intellectually. My suspicion is that you're applying your normal mental apparatus with too much effort and then getting angry at yourself because the understanding is not coming in the way that you might expect to understand a textbook, an ordinary textbook. It's a different process. We try to make it as clear as possible, and at some point it's just like you need to let it cook inside you and let that part of you which knows, which recognizes the truth in these teachings, let that part of you recognize it. And don't worry about what your mind thinks or about feeling like you're not receiving the teachings in the right way. You are totally receiving them in the right way. And that this feeling of I can't do it is, again, in my experience, the impasse that will often, if you can let yourself sit in it, do the meditation, work with the affirmations, the shift happens and your state changes. And it's in the change of state that the truth of these teachings begins to reveal itself. So again, thank you for offering us this question. And if anyone else is feeling that way, I just want to encourage you to stay with the meditation, work with the affirmations, and listen to the class a few times. So let's just close our eyes and be with the breath. When all else fails, when everything seems impossible to understand, when life just doesn't seem to make any sense, flowing back to the awareness of the breath, feeling how the breath simply flows into the body and flows out of the body. And beginning to sense the breath actually flowing in through the entire front of your body, almost as though the body opens, the skin opens to receive the breath. Recognizing that you don't have to do anything to make the breath flow. Just allowing yourself to receive it, the breath that is always flowing. Moment by moment by moment. As the most palpable expression of the Great Mother's intention for our lives. Just let yourself experience that love, which is the heart of this universe, breathing you. So I just want to bring us back to what I feel is the epigraph of this course. Stay where you are without worrying, for the goal is assured. And who but the self, meaning the great self, could speak this, and to whom? So much love, and thank you for bringing your questions and your attention and all your inner practice to this gathering tonight. And we will reconvene on Wednesday. Have a great evening and day, and much, much love.